Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. This week has seen some fairly significant developments in the immigration debate, both at the federal and state levels. In Washington, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators proposed an immigration framework that would include a path toward citizenship for some 11 million undocumented immigrants. A similar plan, also bipartisan, is being developed in the U.S. House, though conventional wisdom suggests it may face stiffer opposition there. Meanwhile, here in the state of Illinois, Governor Pat Quinn this week signed legislation that allows undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. On today's program, we'll learn more about these developments in Washington and in Springfield, and then we will turn our attention to the current immigration process, how people do come legally to the United States, and we will welcome your questions about that process, how they become residents, and ultimately how they become citizens. First, though, to discuss developments in Springfield and Washington, D.C., we are joined by two guests. Felicia Sonmez is the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Felicia, welcome to Focus.
Hi, Craig. Great to be with you.
I'm glad to have you with us. And Amanda Vinicky is the State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Amanda, thank you for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Let me start with Felicia. Felicia, what do we know about the bipartisan plan out of the U.S. Senate?
Well, as you mentioned, Craig, this has been a big week of developments here in Washington on this issue. A bipartisan group of eight senators has unveiled not legislation, but their set of principles, a bipartisan framework on comprehensive immigration reform. That's the first time that we've seen this issue really come up on Capitol Hill for the past 3 years, and even the last time it came up back in 2010, that was a very short-lived effort. So you're seeing this come up in the Senate. You've got some bipartisan members in the House as well saying that they're meeting and they're going to be planning some hearings on this coming up pretty soon. And then you have the president, who this week made a trip to Las Vegas, Nevada, to sort of, you know, from his bully pulpit, really push Congress on the issue. He had a couple of interviews with Spanish language television networks yesterday where he pushed Congress to act on this by March, to introduce legislation by then at the latest. So you're really seeing a real urgency here on this issue that you haven't seen for quite a couple of years.
Do we have any sense of how the plan out of the Senate, that sort of framework, might differ from what members of the House are seeking to draw up?
Right now, we don't know too much about what is going on the House side. The Senate plan, which was unveiled this week, we do know a little bit more about that. I think what's interesting to note is the ways that it differs from what the president has said in the past that he would support. You know, one of the major sort of obstacles here will be whether or not that pathway to citizenship for those undocumented immigrants will be tied to the issue of border security. On the Republican side, that's a major deal breaker, and Marco Rubio, the Republican from Florida, and a couple of others have said that that's real necessary for them to support this plan, and the president has previously said that he wouldn't include that in his overhaul. So that's just, then there's a whole lot of other details on this, too, that could be sticking points as this goes forward.
Why is there momentum now in Washington for this when it seemed an intractable issue just a few months ago?
You know, everyone who's involved in this denies that the election was really any part of this push, but I think the numbers are undeniable. When you have, you know, Barack Obama and Joe Biden getting 70% of the Latino vote in November, it was pretty hard for the Republican Party to look at that and not try to reassess its strategy over the next couple of years. I think the Republican primary in 2012 in particular was pretty damaging for a lot of the candidates who ran. Mitt Romney, who was not really strident on this issue before, took some pretty extreme positions back then. So I think now you're just seeing, at least on the Republican side, a view that the party's previous positions on this are untenable and that they need to change course in some way.
Still, there are some lawmakers who are balking at the idea, as they don't want to offer what they see as amnesty to people who came to this country without going through the proper channels. Has the White House signaled any intention to make any specific efforts to try to persuade those lawmakers, or are they looking to try and build some sort of broad-based bipartisan coalition with those that are seeing some sort of political shift?
It's interesting. The amnesty question is a big one on the Republican side. You've got a couple of members this week coming out, David Vitter, a prominent conservative from Louisiana, a couple of conservative radio talk show hosts have come out and criticized Rubio, who's the main sort of backer of this plan on the Republican side, and they've called it amnesty. I think, you know, in both chambers, you're going to have Republican members who will deem any comprehensive immigration reform effort amnesty, no matter what the actual details of that plan are. And as far as the White House goes, I think the strategy that they're pursuing here is to take as little of an active role in actually crafting this legislation as possible. They know that it's tough for Republican members to sign on to something that has the president's stamp of approval on it. So they're just sort of holding back for now and letting this group of eight do their work on it.
Amanda Vinicky, meanwhile, here in Illinois, Governor Quinn signed legislation Sunday that allows undocumented immigrants to obtain a driver's license. Illinois is the fourth state to do this. What have proponents of this new legislation cited as the benefits?
Well, they say that the problem right now is that there are about 250,000 immigrants driving on Illinois' roads without licenses, and that means that they don't have proper training, and generally it means that they also don't have any insurance. So when a driver who is in the country legally and ostensibly has insurance, because that is required by Illinois law, you know, gets into an accident, that kind of messes up the works there. It's also, they say, just dangerous because, again, these people haven't had vision tests. They haven't had any driving instructions or passed a driver's test. And so that is the primary line that we are getting from supporters of this measure. And I'll say those supporters are both Republicans and Democrats.
What about those who are opponents of it? What have they had to say?
Well, opponents say that, first of all, they have concerns about fraud. This driver's license is just temporary, so it's not as if it goes into perpetuity. It also will look different than a driver's license. Not all that different. You know, I mean, it's still an ID card, but it'll have basically a purple banner that says this cannot be used as identification. So someone who does have this TDL, as they are known, can't buy firearms. They won't be able to board a plane. Nonetheless, critics cite other states that have had a form of license like this and saying that having two classes just doesn't work, that it gets into a bureaucratic mess, that it is very rife with fraud, either people coming from other states, whereas Illinois is trying to deal with that by requiring applicants prove that they've been in the state of Illinois and have been residents for more than a year, that in other states where this has been tried, that didn't quite happen. And people, you know, came from all other states, and it became a form of identification that was used for all sorts of other means.
As I said, Illinois is one of only four states allowing undocumented immigrants to obtain a driver's license. New Mexico and Washington State offer licenses, Utah permits. Why do you suppose the state of Illinois is among those four?
Well, again, I do think that part of it gets back to the elections. If you look back and 10 years ago, so 1992, the census said about 8% of Illinois' population was Latino, and at that time, 1% of voters were. Fast forward to November, and 16% of the population, so basically the population of Latinos in Illinois doubled, but far more than that came out to voting booths. 12% of voters were Latino. Overwhelmingly, they went Democratic. You look at, for instance, Barack Obama got 81% of the Latino vote in Illinois. And I think that, again, not that there weren't some Republicans who had been supportive of at least this effort or thought about it in the past, because there are many that do see this as a safety issue. But I think that really the writing was on the wall and that pushed the agenda. This has been something that, since I was an intern here in the Capitol back in what, gosh, I'm dating myself, but back in 2005, there were attempts that were seen as just that, attempts. It was pretty clear that it wasn't going to go forward. But after those election results came in, after you saw increases in the Latino community, DuPage County, a Republican bastion and kind of thought of as a wealthy area, predominantly white, and the increase in the Latino population there, this really was on the, to make a somewhat, I guess, intentional pun, fast track, and did get passed pretty darn quickly with, again, bipartisan support.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel said this week that the new law should serve as a model for the nation. Could this law, Amanda, be a sign that the way the debate over immigration is being framed and being addressed may change?
You know, it may well be. I think that, again, this actually, I should point out that whereas this is now law, immigrants who are living here without the proper paperwork will not be able to get a license right away. It's going to take about 10 months for the Secretary of State to get the program up and running. So it remains to be seen how this will actually work. But in terms of the debate, very much so. I think that, as you previously talked about in this program, on the national level, there's a lot of pressure, and that is coming from Latinos, that is coming from candidates, that is coming from, for instance, the Illinois State Party, that I think is trying to recognize that and pushing the national agenda, and Rahm Emanuel is not alone there. I know that, for example, the sponsor of this measure, who is Democratic Representative Eddie Acevedo, said he hopes this sends a signal to Washington. Illinois, not only the fourth state, but also the largest of the states that has a program in place to give illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants a way to be able to drive legally on the roads.
Felicia, we talked about November's election results, but does a new state law allowing for driver's licenses in Illinois in any way signal to federal lawmakers that a shift may be taking place in the immigration debate?
I think it is definitely an important signal, and the interesting thing on the driver's licenses issue in particular, the first thing that it made me think of as a political reporter was back in the 2008 Democratic primary when in one of the debates it was Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama, and the question was asked of, would you support such a measure? And I remember that candidate Clinton at the time was a little bit tongue-tied on whether or not she'd support that. So I think politically it's that the driver's licenses issue in particular is quite a, I guess, a polarizing one or a tricky one, one of many in immigration more broadly as a pretty difficult one. So I don't know necessarily, you know, how that would play out on the federal level, but I just hearkened back to that and how tough that was even for a Democratic primary.
Amanda, should we anticipate any other bills associated with immigration to be considered by Illinois legislators in the current session?
I haven't heard any talk of that at this juncture. What I do think there will be a lot of is, again, pressure from Illinois, both the Latinos in the congressional delegation. Luis Gutierrez, of course, has been very out in front on that. Also from a growing Latino caucus. When you look at the Illinois House and Senate, of course, there are Democratic majorities in supermajorities, in fact, in both chambers of the General Assembly, and there are growing numbers of Latinos. And so whereas there may not be necessarily legislation that gets attention to this degree, it will for sure become an issue in a lot of budget debates and where state dollars should be directed in programs that give to English as a second language in education, into a lot of the community service programs. You are, I think, going to see a growing influence there. And I will mention that that is going to remain, I think, a challenge for Illinois Republicans, whereas you saw party leaders, both Christine Rodonio and Tom Cross, the minority leaders of the Senate and House, respectively, come out in favor of this legislation. There are still pretty white-looking caucuses. There are not either Latinos nor African-Americans in the Illinois House or Senate on the Republican side of the aisle. And that is something where I think they're going to have to look in terms of candidate recruiting and really getting into those communities.
Finally, for Felicia, you mentioned that President Obama is exerting some measure of pressure to have something move quickly. I know on Wednesday he said he hoped to sign a federal immigration bill by the end of the year. Based on how proposed legislation on big issues like this tends to move in Washington, D.C., is that realistic?
I think it's unrealistic. Having covered Capitol Hill throughout all of the debt and spending debates of 2011, it's very difficult for Congress to even move on legislation that it's required to do. So keeping the federal government funded, those kinds of things typically go until the last minute, and you've got some kind of 11th hour deal being made that does the very bare minimum of what it needs to do. So on issues as big as this one, and where you've got so much complicated detail to get into on this and a lot of opportunities for opposition, I think you may get legislation through by the end of the year. I mean, another difficult thing is just that there's a whole lot of other agenda items happening there right now. You've got gun reform. You've got still these other debt ceiling debates happening this year. So knowing the way that Congress tends to work, it could be a pretty tough climb for them.
Felicia Selmez is the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Felicia, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
And Amanda Vinicky is the State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Amanda, thank you for talking with us as well.
My appreciation to you.
All right. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing immigration on today's program. And as we and everyone else have presented countless shows examining the debate over immigration currently playing out in Washington, we thought it might be more instructive to spend the rest of today's show discussing how the immigration system works today. Specifically, how someone who wants to become a resident and then become a U.S. citizen through the proper channels can seek to do so. To help us understand that process and to field your questions about how the immigration system currently works, we are joined by Jeffrey Hayes. He's an immigration attorney with the law firm of Irwin, Martinkus & Cole in Champaign. Jeff Hayes, welcome to Focus.
Good morning.
Glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
And we, of course, welcome you to the conversation as well. What would you like to know about how immigrants become ultimately U.S. citizens today? How do green cards work? What does it mean to have a work visa? What do you have to do to establish U.S. citizenship? We welcome any questions you have about that process at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or find us and comment on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. So, Jeff, take us through the process of becoming a U.S. citizen. If someone wants to come to this country, wants to live here, work here, become a resident, and ultimately become a citizen and do so through the proper channels, where do they start?
There are four main ways for people to immigrate. There is asylum and refugee status. I think there are 10,000 of those visas allowed each year. That's one way. Someone presents themselves at our border and claims an asylum, and there's a process that would take them through that. There's the diversity lottery. We have 55,000 visas a year, which are segregated for a lottery. It's online, and people can sign up. It is limited to those countries which are basically underrepresented. So you wouldn't see Mexico, Canada, China, the Philippines, India. Those countries wouldn't be allowed to be in the diversity lottery. But the idea is to bring people from obscure countries, smaller countries, to improve our ethnicity, the melting pot, which has gotten us the great country that we are. There are family-based and employment-based, and those are the only two other ways to immigrate. And they both have non-immigrant visas, which is basically an intent issue. Eventually, I decide I'll go back home. Or there's immigrant visa, which means I really want to stay here on a permanent basis, which leads to the term legal permanent resident, which in the vernacular is the green card.
Okay. So how many people ultimately then immigrate to the U.S. each year?
I don't have a firm number on that because there are so many exceptions. The other category, or within the family base, there is what's called an immediate relative. So if you are a U.S. citizen, you can sponsor your spouse or a parent. So there is no limit on the number of people that can do that. However, Congress has micromanaged, for whatever reason, a quota. And in the family base, it's 226,000 visas, and in the employment base, it's 140,000 visas. In the employment base, that may sound like a lot, but that's the entire amount for an entire year, and as a result, it's always oversubscribed. More than that wants to come here. And part of the problem, and one thing hopefully the new legislation will address, is the way they count that number. So, for instance, if I represent someone who has an employment-based path to a green card, and they're married with two children, that's four of the 140. It doesn't count just the principal that's going to be the worker, but rather it counts their entire family. So that limits the number of employment visas, and therefore there are many-year waits for even the best and the brightest from around the world.
All right. So I'm trying to do some quick math here, and I'm thinking, okay, employment visa is about 140,000, family visa is about 226,000. I think you said 50,000, and the diversity lot.
55,000, right.
55,000, and about, did you say about 10,000 a year?
10,000 asylum, right.
So that's somewhere north of 400,000 visas, and that could represent, because we're talking about multiple people sometimes through the same visa, could be as many as 1 to 2 million people a year.
The waiting line's probably 3 to 4 million people.
That's what my next question was.
Right.
So do we have a clear sense of how many more people consistently want to come here, live here, and theoretically ultimately become citizens here versus the number that actually do?
There's actually a person counting that in Washington, and he every month publishes what's called the Visa Bulletin. And his job is to take worldwide demand and try and figure out how far forward each month he should put their each individual case's priority date. When do they get in line? And once they're in line, if demand exceeds supply, then they have to wait. And he decides every month how many people can come. And there's an actual count, and it goes back many, many years, because each one of these employment or family-based categories have different categories within that. And so it's complicated. It's a complicated count. And he has to try and gauge how many people are waiting at a consulate overseas, how many people may be here in the United States working, and gauge that. Sometimes he pushes the date too far forward and too many people get in line, so the dates actually move backwards, retrogress, as we call it. So it's a system that the foreign population looks at. It's only public, the visa bulletin is only published once a month, and boy, in the middle of the month, they're all looking at that number to say, how close am I getting? Can I get in line? Can I actually apply for my green card?
You mentioned that there's this diversity lottery that's specific to those countries that are maybe underrepresented in terms of the number of folks that may immigrate to the U.S. Does that mean that when it comes to the family and employment visas, those are generally handed out to a small number of countries that are sort of largely represented, or is it just a wide who knows who?
Well, there are basically a different line for China, Mexico, the Philippines, and India. Those four countries have a waiting list, and also Congress has mandated that no one country gets more than 7% of any of the visas that are available. So obviously, Greenland gets as many visas as China or India. So there's an inequity there that probably needs to be addressed in this new legislation if it's eventually successful, because we are keeping out those PhD people. We're making them stand in line, whereas Greenland, for instance, maybe have as many people who wanted to come here. So the rest of the world is in one line, and then those four countries are in another.
So if you come from a country with a smaller population, your chances of becoming a U.S. citizen are greater.
Correct. Over time. Faster.
Faster.
Sure.
When you say faster, how long of a waiting list are we talking about for these nations?
The employment list is hard, but it's probably for someone that has a PA, that has a I did bring a copy of the visa bulletin, so
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll let you look that up. And while you're doing that, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we are discussing immigration on today's program. As we and everyone else have presented a number of shows examining the debate over immigration policy that's currently playing out in Washington, we thought we might spend the bulk of today's show offering you a chance to get any questions you want answered about how the immigration system actually works today, specifically how someone who wants to become a U.S. citizen through the proper channels can seek to do so. To help us understand that process, we're joined by Jeff Hayes. He's an immigration attorney with the law firm of Irwin, Martinkus & Cole in Champaign, and we welcome your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or find us in comment on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580.
So let me give you an example. If you have a master's degree from a U.S. university and you're from India and you've done everything correctly through your employment, they're working on cases filed prior to September 1st, 2004. So just on the face of it, it's almost a 9-year wait. In actuality, it doesn't move day for day, so it could even be longer. So if you're in our country and you're here legally, you can be on a non-immigrant visa, so you have the right to work and stay. But to get to that green card, which then would be a path to citizenship, you might have a 9 to 15-year wait. Well, that puts a lot of pressure on a family to decide whether they're going to stay here for the rest of their lives, invest in their community, own a home, et cetera. So that uncertainty, I think, is a real problem for the best and the brightest around the world.
So give us some other examples. How is the waiting list longer or shorter for various nations?
That same person that has a master's degree from China is January 15th of 2008.
All right, so that's about 5 years minimum waiting period, it would seem.
And if you have a bachelor's degree, it's even a longer wait. So you're looking at November of 06 or November of 02 for similarly situated people. So we value your education, so you're on a faster track the more education you have, but still it's a very long wait.
And you had noted to me before the show started that for Mexico, that wait could be very, very long indeed.
Well, on the family-based side, there are a number of different categories. But, for instance, if you were from Mexico and became a U.S. citizen and you wanted your family, you say your brother or your sister's family, if you wanted to petition for them, it's a 162-year wait. If you are an unmarried adult child of a legal permanent resident, can be anywhere from a 10 to 119-year wait. That's how many people are in line waiting. So there's not much benefit there for someone to petition for family members or things like that.
Let's take a couple of calls. We have Robert on the line from New York. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, Craig. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi.
I'm an immigration lawyer here in New York, and that was a nice explanation by Jeffrey. One of the components, though, is, you know, that deals with basically future entrants and people who are here legally, but there's 11, 12, 13 million people here illegally that are basically stuck because either they came in here without a visa or they came here with a visa, supposed to stay here for 6 months, and wow, it's 10 years later and they're still here. And, you know, these four channels that people have to get their green cards really aren't, in effect, available to them because once they're illegal, it's very hard under the current laws to get status here and to get it back. And they're sort of trapped because if they go home, they're now subject to current law is, which is you're subject to a 10-year bar. So there's the component of people that are here illegally and there's the component of people that want to come in. And that's why the sort of border security and the immigration reform has to go hand in hand because they did the system back in the 80s and they let people claim themselves and get residence, but they didn't shut the borders. So, voila, we still have 11 million people here that are illegal. So that's basically why I feel everything has to go hand in hand and, you know, sort of shut the borders only to legal entrants and fix it for the people that are here now that are illegal and sort of trapped.
Jeff, this gets back to something else we talked about off-air before the show, the laws of unintended consequences.
Right. Robert and I would agree that there was a law in 1996 fondly called IRA-IRA, which led to a penalty of 3 or a 10-year ban or even a permanent ban for people that were overstays or who entered illegally. And you know, I think the Congress's intent was that everyone would leave and not want to incur that ban. And, of course, 180 degrees later, everyone stayed. And so the unintended consequences of our laws in 1986 and 1996 have sort of made this underclass of people, the 11 million people here. So they're here and we need to deal with them, and that's part of the comprehensive immigration reform we all, as immigration lawyers, hope is addressed. We do need to attract the best and brightest, and we do need to make sure that the skilled people have an easier path, if you will, or a more clear path. But we also have to deal with this 11 million people who are now, some of them have been here for 20 years, 15 years, and are really part of the fabric of our communities. And we have to deal with it.
I want to talk some more about the legislation, but I want to say thanks to Robert for his call. And we'll go next to Jeff in Piatone. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, guys. You know, all this stuff is kind of frustrating when you have family. It went through the system the proper way, and now you're being crapped on, excuse the expression. But my family, all of them came through except for myself and my wife, and we're both born American. But it's kind of a shame that, you know, especially the Europeans go through such rough times trying to make it here, and they do what they're supposed to, and yet the people south of the border get away with murder. I mean, and here's my point I'm trying to make, okay? The gentleman that called in earlier before me, he's got kind of a point, and, you know, I'm in the trades. I see a lot of people taking advantage of these so-called illegals or, you know, people not wanted here. But yet they're the only ones that'll do the job.
All right, I'm going to stop you there because I'm Jeff's sort of shaking his head, and I want to give him a chance to respond to it.
Jeff, I agree with you. I know that part of the legislation, any comprehensive immigration plan, can't put people who are here illegally ahead of those that are illegally. And I've not read anything in any drafts that would suggest that will happen. But it certainly is a big problem that has to be dealt with. And so there are going to be probably a lot of different proposals. But whether you call it an amnesty or some penalty or however we're going to deal with this, certainly I agree with you that I have clients who do things perfectly legally, and they shouldn't have to wait longer because there's another class of people or another kind of visa that's been created.
It may be a matter of semantics. It may be terminology. But I wanted to sort of stress one thing that you mentioned to me before the show, which is this idea that the people themselves are not illegal. It's just it's the system itself, however the system is designed, determines whether or not the process they're using is taking them into the country legally or not, right?
And another, I think, component of it is both in 86 and 96, most of the legislation put the burden on the employer to be the policeman. And that's not really a function that they want. So most employers that I know are interested in someone doing a day's work for a day's pay and doing it correctly. And yet, if they have to be the policeman to know whether their documents are correct or not, that gives them a whole function that they're not prepared to do. Part of the new legislation probably will be some sort of electronic e-verify system, and whether employers will have some tools to do that, it'll make it easier for them. That remains to be seen.
Caller mentioned previous generations. You know, most of us don't have to go back more than a few generations to find our own families were immigrants. How is the experience, the legal system, different today than it was for the influx of immigrants in the early 20th century, the flood of immigrants who came through Ellis Island?
Well, and that's interesting. A lot of times I'll hear people comment, well, you know, my grandparents came here legally. Well, they came here legally if they could get here. There weren't laws. As long as you were arrived and probably were healthy, you were allowed to come through Ellis Island. So at the turn of the century, there really wasn't much other than to get here. And we really didn't start to think about this until the 1920s, where we started to have national origin quotas, where they were actually, we'll only take so many Germans, we'll take only so many Polish, etc. And we've been tinkering with it ever since. In the 30s, we had the Great Depression. We probably had an outflux of people. People weren't coming here. And then, of course, after the Second World War, you had war brides coming. So there were more laws being passed. Really, the granddaddy of all immigration was in 1954 when we had the Immigration and Naturalization Act. And then there's been some mileposts since then, the 86 Act, which was called the Immigration and Reform Control Act during the Reagan years, 1996, and then at the end of the Clinton year in 2001.
I want to talk some more about those laws in 86 and 96. First, a reminder, my guest is Jeff Hayes. He's an immigration attorney with the law firm of Irwin, Martinkus & Cole in Champaign, and we are fielding your questions about the immigration process and how someone becomes an American citizen. We welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can post your questions on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. And we will take more of your calls after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the immigration and naturalization process with Jeffrey Hayes. He's an immigration attorney with the law firm of Irwin, Martinkus & Cole in Champaign. He's here to field your questions about how people, through the proper channels, become residents of the United States and ultimately U.S. citizens. And you can call with your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or again, you can find us and comment or post questions on Facebook or Twitter at Focus580. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. All right, so we've been talking around, dancing around these two pieces of legislation that have, I guess, impacted how our immigration system works today. Tell us a little bit about what the Immigration Control Act of 1986 said and what its effects were.
Okay, that was passed during the Reagan years, and basically it required the employer to determine their employee's immigration status. It also made it illegal to knowingly hire or recruit unauthorized immigrants. There was a component that legalized seasonal agricultural immigrants. And then there was an amnesty of sorts. That people were able to take advantage of if they had arrived prior to 1982. So I think the problem with IRCA, as we call it, is that it it made employers be the police, but you can't discriminate against someone based on their national origin. So there was sort of a dichotomy between saying, hey, I need to see where you're from and whether you have the legal authority to work in the United States, but just because I look at the color of your skin or your accent, I can't ask you that question. So, and then it was never enforced. There was just no will by the people from employers that cared about it. And so people came and went, and as long as people were able to work and you didn't ask too many questions, everything was okay.
Then in 1996, we had the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. Did I get that right?
You got it right. We call it IRA-IRA. And basically, that set up this scheme of 3 and 10-year bans based on how long you had been here as an overstay or you had entered illegally. Congress thought everyone would just leave. You'd go back home and then try and come back legally. And, of course, the exact opposite effect. No one left. They didn't want to. They had invested in their communities. They may have owned a home. They had jobs. And they said, well, why would I give that up? Or I'm worried I'd give that up and I'll never get back. So basically, they never left. And that led to the number of people we have today.
So let's get back to the process of becoming a U.S. citizen. Let's say, despite all of the waiting lists and the time period and everything, the challenges we've talked about, you are one of those people that is finding your way through the process. Are there tests associated with becoming a citizen? Are there costs associated? What sort of processes do you go through?
On the family-based side, some of it is simply relational. You have to prove who you are. So if it was a marriage to U.S. citizen case, for instance, we would submit the bona fides of the marriage to show that they are commingling their lives like normal married people do. And from there, there's probably an interview and to make sure they have a legitimate marriage. And this whole process, at least in the Central District of Illinois or through the Chicago District Office, could take anywhere from 6 months would be very fast and maybe up to a year. So that would be a family-based case. If you're overseas and you're bringing someone here, the same process, there's another step through what's called the National Visa Center, and they regulate the appointment times with the consulates, and the same process would be for them to enter. That can, once again, if you were married, came back to the U.S., you might not see your spouse for a year.
How about if you are taking a job in the United States and you've accepted the job and you want to become a full citizen and the determination is made, yes, this is somebody we want around for a while.
So if a normal progression would be some sort of non-immigrant visa,
yeah.
And then there are too many categories to probably go into it in specifics, but basically while you're working on a non-immigrant visa, you could ask your employer to sponsor you and go through a process called labor certification, and at the end of the day, if all of that's approved, you look back to that visa bulletin to say, I'm now in line. Do I get a green card or do I have to stay on this non-immigrant visa and wait?
What about knowledge about the United States? What do you need to know to become a citizen?
Once again, moving forward then from you have to be a green card holder. You have to be a legal permanent resident for at least 5 years if it's an employment-based or if it's the one exception would be marriage to U.S. citizen. You can petition to become a citizen in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you have to have good moral character. There are some residency requirements in terms of being here. And then you have to pass the citizenship test. There's 100 questions. It's online. And you have to pass that. You have to be able to write English and read English. Some exceptions for older people that have been here for many, many years. But for the most part, you have to pass a citizenship test.
What about costs, directly or indirectly?
The citizenship petition to become a citizen, and the filing fee is $680.
All right. Well, that's
and you have
not
to be,
some change.
Yeah, you have to be fingerprinted biometrically. So it's probably, at least for people in central Illinois, a trip to either Chicago or Indianapolis or St. Louis. A couple passport photos and an interview.
All right. So there is some cost.
There is some cost.
Sure.
Yeah. Every one of these petitions, every time you ask for a benefit, there is a cost to the fee.
Let's take some more calls. We'll go next to Brian in Champaign. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Good morning. Very interesting conversation. I just want to take note of one thing. I know that you mentioned that, and it was a good point you made, but just to extrapolate on it, the notion that you could sort of show up at Ellis Island and that was kind of how it was done. One thing to note is, and I think you mentioned quotas, the 1924 Immigration Act, I didn't remember all the specifics of it. I knew about it, but I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, and it's reminding me here that it not only tried to restrict Jews, for example, and certain Southern Eastern Europeans, but it prohibited the immigration of all Middle Easterners, East Asians, and Indians. That did not change until 1965, and so I just wanted to take note of the watershed, historically speaking, probably world historically speaking, aspect of the 1965 Act, because even today, whether you try to get into Japan or elsewhere, it's extremely difficult, you know, and things have really changed in this country. But I did want to take note of the glaringly racist aspect of the policies from the early 1920s to the mid-1960s.
All right. Thanks very much for the comments. Any thoughts, Jeff?
He's right. I mean, we've tried to micromanage the number of people. Every group, it seems, has come under some scrutiny. There was too many Irish. There were too many Germans. We had the Chinese Exclusion Act after the railroads had been built. We looked around and said, boy, there's a lot of Chinese people here. Maybe we should exclude them. So there have been efforts to have fewer Europeans or no Japanese, as he says, at various times.
Next up is Phil in Decatur. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how you doing? I have a question for your guest. I'm personally involved because at one point I had a partner who was deported back to Germany under a glitch in the law back in 1999. And do you think possibly – I'm under the impression, based on what I've studied, that the revision, the Immigration Act of 1996, is where a lot of the present-day problems started. They changed the immigration laws enough to make them virtually both at once unreasonable and unenforceable, and that's what's given us virtually what amounts to a humanitarian problem rather than a legal problem.
All right. Thanks for the question.
Certainly.
There's going to be considerations for the Defense of Marriage Act with partners, and that's not really been forefront of the debate, but that's certainly something that the gay community is going to want to think about. Civil unions didn't exist back in, at least in the immigration policies back in the 86 and 96. I guess I would only disagree with the caller slightly. Just in my mind, 1986 is the watershed, and when employers became the people that had to police whether people were here legally or not. They didn't care, and the government didn't either at the time.
We have an email from Nathan, and he asks, for a person starting out on the employment-based path, you stated the very long wait time. Are there milestones to let the person know where he is on the path or whether or not he is approved or not? Or do you just wait for 9 years and find out at the last minute if you have to leave?
No, there are certain steps along the way where you would know you were in an approved status. You may have a renewable visa that at some points is only 1 year renewable, but then you take another step and it's now 3 years renewable. So you would know at the end of the process when your priority date becomes current that you have a great likelihood, given that you have good moral character and there's not a bunch of criminal activity, those kinds of things. But if you're otherwise qualified, the likelihood is that you know you're going to be approved for a green card.
How do they define good moral character? And who makes that determination?
That's a topic for another show.
well,
I mean, there are federal laws that define what's a crime. There are state laws that define what's a crime. And each state has different requirements. So what might be a crime involving moral turpitude in Indiana might not be that same crime in Illinois. But
generally speaking, we're talking about whether a person has a criminal record. Is that essentially
correct?
The litmus?
I'll give you an example. Under the recent executive order, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, simple misdemeanors were not a problem. A DUI would be a problem. Felonies, certainly a problem. So it's fair to say that any felony is going to cause serious harm to your immigration case. Simple traffic matters, a speeding ticket, not so much.
We have this comment from Rowana who wants to chime in a little bit on costs. He says, my husband came to the States from Canada so that we could be married. While the process is, as your guest states, what he's not mentioning is that it's not automatic. We had to prove that I could afford to support my husband. She says, my income wasn't enough, so we had to ask a friend to sign papers that they would support him if necessary. On top of that, the cost of getting a green card is onerous. The filing fee is $600 or more, but there are also the lawyer fees, which are not cheap, and it's nearly impossible to do without the guidance of a lawyer. The total cost for us was well over $1,800, plus the good graces of a good friend to sponsor him.
True. Marriage to if it's a marriage to U.S. citizen case, you have the sponsoring spouse has to file an affidavit of support, and there are guidelines about how much the size of the family must make. We don't want to bring people into the United States that are just going to go on and become a public charge. If that individual, and I have a lot of clients that they end up, maybe they're just a new graduate, maybe they're just returning from overseas, and they don't have income sufficient. So they have to get a co-sponsor, typically a family member. And basically it's a promise that the person you're sponsoring won't be a public charge for a period of 10 years or until they become a citizen.
Some people have dual citizenship. How does that work, and which countries allow for it?
You have to check each country. In my work, I have... know of some countries because I've had to address the issue. Austria, for instance, doesn't allow dual citizenship, and you would lose a great deal if you renounced your Austrian citizenship. Australia is very strict. Most countries, and certainly in the United States, when you take the oath and the swearing-in ceremony, you're pledging allegiance to our country. We don't object to having dual citizenship. Germany is another case where someone going back to Germany that becomes a U.S. citizen has to go through a process there to maintain their citizenship. So each country is a little different. Indians that become United States citizens have to go through a renunciation process that's kind of onerous.
Some states, I imagine, have a greater stake in how the immigration process works than other states in the country. How about for Illinois and Indiana? What impact does it have on these states, largely, particularly maybe even central Illinois, west central Indiana, agricultural communities? How does that impact?
Yeah, sure. I mean, clearly we know that the border states, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, have the biggest issue because they have the border with Mexico.
Right.
They also are high agricultural states, so they have the issues there. Florida has a large Hispanic population. New York, just by sheer population. Certainly, Illinois. I think we're in the top 10 with the number of immigrants. And as the callers earlier, or the one of your guests earlier said, the Latino population is, I think she said, 16% in the state of Illinois. I think it depends a lot on agriculture. Those states that have passed, Arizona, Alabama, some other states that have tried to address this issue on their own have made it very difficult for people to stay there, illegal immigrants to stay there and to work with severe penalties. And so their agricultural communities have suffered because of it.
If you could wave a magic wand and you could
president for a day?
Forget president for a day. We're talking the magic wand and just change the current immigration system, America's current policies towards citizenship, what would you change today?
Probably my emphasis would first be on allowing graduates of U.S. universities with advanced degrees to have an easier path to a green card. It probably would take some cases out of the immigration attorney's pockets, basically, because we do work with them. But it would be the right thing for our country to maintain the best and the brightest, to prevent brain drain, if you will. We have to deal with other end of the continuum is this illegal population that's largely unskilled. And so we have to find a way to make it work for them as well.
Do we have the infrastructure, the capability, forget the political will, to address those issues?
Well, it's interesting. The current administration deported the maximum, really, that the system will do over the first 4 years of the administration. Almost 400,000 a year have been deported. So there's been a strong push for enforcement. I don't know that they get much credit for that, but we don't. That's about all we can do. We have immigration judges these cases have to be heard. Are we going to build detention centers to keep all these people? I mean, there's a huge amount of money that have to be dedicated if we just said we're not going to pass any new laws and we're going to get rid of everyone. So it's just probably not, as a practical matter, we could even do that.
All right, but what about the opposite, to do things as you are suggesting? if we were, you know, if that magic wand approach could happen?
Well, USCIS, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, which is the service side of the old Immigration and Naturalization Service, is getting better in terms of addressing things electronically, electronic filings. Certainly when a new law goes into effect, they're going to have to take a deep breath and get busy. Whether they can do 10 million new cases or not would probably be a problem. The deferred action for childhood arrivals recently, you know, they're well over, I think, 400,000, and those are proceeding. I mean, they're getting done.
Jeffrey Hayes is an immigration attorney with the law firm of Irwin, Martinkus & Cole in Champaign. Jeff, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We welcome any additional thoughts you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's program, it has been 10 years since the space shuttle Columbia exploded on reentry over Texas, killing 7 astronauts. While the shuttle program continued for some years thereafter, state-funded spaceflight really drew down in the decade that followed. Now space is becoming more of a private industry. We'll talk about the future of space travel on Friday's Focus with Michael Lopez Alegria, former astronaut and president of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation. He'll discuss experiences in space and what needs to happen for commercial space tourism and research to become a reality. We'll also talk with Philippe Gubel, a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Illinois and the director of the Illinois Space Grant Consortium, about funding for aerospace education for the next generation, and Jonathan Card, executive director of the Space Frontier Foundation, which is dedicated to opening the space frontier to human settlement as rapidly as possible. We'll welcome your thoughts, too, on the future of space exploration. That's on Friday's Focus. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft's our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.